Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last year, on October 2nd, the largest dam removal project in history was completed, freeing 420 miles of the Klamath River and its tributaries in California and Oregon. Decades of activism led by tribal communities resulted in the removal of four dams that had severely impacted salmon populations, wildlife, entire ecosystems, and the indigenous peoples who depend on the river. In Amy Bowers Cordalis's new book, the Klamath River is the main character, as it is an ancient relative. Her new book is called The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. She writes, "The Klamath Dams embody the legacy of the dark underbelly of the founding of this country that supported the industrialization of nature at the expense of indigenous peoples, the environment, and marginalized communities. The ecological consequences of colonization, while devastating, need not be permanent. Dam removal sends a clear message. Indigenous rights, leadership, and lifeways are not obstacles to progress. They are critical tools for sustaining life on Earth that we all should embrace. Dam removal can end the colonial era on the Klamath River and begin a new era of healing through restorative justice. This starts with mutual respect for the rights of indigenous peoples, nature, and business." Amy Bowers Cordalis is a member and former general counsel of the Yurok Nation, the largest indigenous nation in the country. She's a fisherwoman and an attorney who was instrumental in fighting on behalf of the Yurok and other nations for removal of the dams on the Klamath River. Amy Cordalis is co-founder and executive director of Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group, an organization that helps indigenous peoples protect and restore the natural and cultural resources they rely on to maintain their identity and sovereignty. Amy Bowers Cordalis has written about her family, the history of the Yurok Nation, and the relationship between her people and the river in her new book, The Water Remembers. If you're in the area, Amy has several events coming up. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera next Thursday, November 6th at 6 p.m. She'll be at Copperfields Books in Santa Rosa next Friday, November 7th at 7 p.m. And she'll be at the Point Reyes Presbyterian Church on Saturday, November 8th at 4 p.m. That's being sponsored by Point Reyes Books. You can find all of this information at klw.org, click news, and then your call. Hi, Amy. Congratulations on this beautiful book, and thank you so much for joining us again.
Guenakoi, thank you for having me.
Well, we love the title of the book, The Water Remembers, which refers to how the water finds its natural path after the dams were removed. Can you talk about how you came up with this beautiful title?
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be on the show. And the title really reflects the Yurok understanding of ecosystems, you know, water, rivers, forests, mountains, in that, you know, while many of those precious ecosystems have been colonized, they also remember how to perform traditional ecological functions in order to be resilient and support life on Earth. And so the Water Remembers is really just a tribute to the strength of these ecosystems that we have on Earth, and sort of a nudge to the humans that if we decolonize, if we, you know, take out dams, remove infrastructure that no longer serves the public, that nature will do its part and heal.
Before we talk about how you got to this place, I just have to ask you, what was your response when you first saw the salmon coming back? Because this is getting a lot of attention in the mass media. In fact, today, SF Gate has a piece called Salmon Seen in Upper Klamath Basin for First Time in Century After Historic Northern California Dam Removal. And they have this beautiful video of salmon swimming in the Upper Klamath Basin. What was it like for you and your family to see this for the first time?
It's remarkable. It is Not unbelievable, because just like the water, the salmon remember, and they remember with a fierceness exactly where they are supposed to be. I had the pleasure last week of going out with crews from the Karuk tribe and with my staff with Bridges to Ripples and pit tagging salmon. That's basically like gently inserting a radio tag into the salmon so that we can track them. And I got to hold one of these remarkable salmon in my hands. And this salmon was just full of life. It was still beautiful, which is remarkable because salmon, they come in from the mouth of the river right at my home village of Rekwoy. And by the time I, you know, was holding this fish, it had traveled over 200 river miles. And yet it was still, you know, this beautiful bright green and kind of chrome color. And you could just feel its vitality. It was so strong. And, you know, most of all, you could feel that it was just on a mission to get back to its spawning grounds. And so, you know, the experience of interacting with these fish, the experience of, and when I say interacting, it's not just that story, but I grew up fishing these same runs of salmon on the Klamath. And in fact, every generation of my family has fished for these exact salmon runs. And so to be at a point in history where these salmon are starting to come home with such resilience and health is just something that I, you know, I've obviously worked towards my whole life, but never thought I would see in my life. And they are just remarkable. They are going up into, you know, past the dams. There's still two dams in the sort of upper part of the river. But they're going past those, they're going through Upper Klamath Lake, and they're going into the Williamson and the Sprague Rivers. And it's just unbelievable. And I really think it just means that it shows us all, it shows every single human that there is hope. Hmm. You know, we live, yeah, there's just hope. So I'll pause there.
Well, and we sure need that right now, because when you yes. think about what we're facing in this country, especially planetary destruction, it must be such an interesting time for you, because the climate, the planet is in trouble on so many levels. Yeah. But at the same time, you're seeing what can happen if you leave it alone to see that these salmon come back. What has that been like for you?
It's remarkable, and it does fill me with hope. And the water remembers, and the story I outline in the book, which I basically, you know, talk about the historical fight, I talk about my own journey, but I also give the sort of blueprint for how we got to Klamath Dam removal. And through that, the story itself is the antidote to the current political and environmental crisis. Because it demonstrates that when humans work to restore ecosystems, that we can in fact rebuild. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to accept, you know, doom and gloom and moving to Mars. you know, and one of the things that I think is a really important message is that, and this is in the book, is, you know, essentially we had an opportunity through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, to relicense the Klamath Dams. And that gave us an opportunity to advocate for dam removal. And we were able to leverage that regulatory process to enter into a settlement agreement that equally valued the rights of nature, the rights of Indigenous peoples, and business. And through dam removal, we pumped over $515 million into the economy. And one of the world's largest construction corporations removed the dams. And what that tells you is that there is an economic model that supports a regenerative economy that could be scalable and replicable around the globe. And that's why I'm really happy about, you know, being able to bring this story to the world, to share this message, because there is hope and we can work to heal the planet. It just means that we have to reevaluate how we do business, but the model is there and it is scalable.
And just to just reiterate just how incredible this is, in the early 2000s, you experienced the largest fish kill in U.S. history. Over 70,000 adult salmon died in the water, and you were home that summer working for Tribal Fisheries, working as a fish technician. You were actually in the boat observing the dead fish. So to think that you had that experience in the early 2000s and then today having the experience of the salmon coming back is just really incredible.
It almost makes me tear up just even hearing you say that. Because I grew up on the river, like so many Indigenous people from the Klamath. You know, we are a fishing people, and we were never removed during colonization. And so even though we had to fight for it, and that fight is outlined in the book, and it included a Supreme Court case by my family. It included what we call the fish wars, the salmon wars, where we were outlawed by the federal government from fishing. You know, our way of life was made illegal, and we fought back in some pretty violent protests. But even through all that, we kept fishing. And because of that, we maintained our deep reliance and our deep relationship on the salmon. And so when those salmon died in 2002, it really felt like an act of ecocide against the Yurok people. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, my nation is still at war with the US government. You know, we later found out that, you know, what caused the fish kill was a fish disease called ick that spread through the whole entire salmon run and killed them. But the disease itself was caused by really bad conditions on the lower Klamath, caused by the dams and low water flows, which basically occurred because of an order by the then Vice President Cheney. And so it just felt like we were still at war with them, and that nobody cared, and that we were literally seeing the end of our culture. You know, we have a myth at Yurok that says, if the salmon die, so too will the Yurok people, because there will be no more need for us on Earth. Mm. So, you know, me and so many others, we felt like it was the end of the world. And so to go from that and then to, you know, launch this Undam the Klamath movement, and now to be at a place where, you know, the whole, like one of the war cries for the Undam the Klamath movement was, undam the Klamath, bring the salmon home. And now they are home, you know, they are home. And so it just feels like, you know, again, we can do it. You know, it's a story of hope. It's a story of taking on, you know, Warren Buffett owned the dams. So taking on one of the richest men in the world, and, you know, the humans win, the fish win. it is like the timing of it, I think, is good. And that's why I hope that people will be able to read it, because I think humanity at this point needs a little bit of, I guess sweet sugar comes to mind, like a little bit of, we're going to be okay. You know, we just have to make some serious adjustments. We have to take things serious. We have to fight for what we believe in, and we have to be dedicated. But one of the other big messages from the Klamath was that there wasn't one single champion of Klamath Dam removal. There were thousands and thousands of people who worked so hard in big and small ways over decades to get us here. And so what you do with your time and your life really matters, and you can make a difference. And that's what the Klamath tells us.
Can you give us a bit more context about how this happened? You also mentioned Dick Cheney's name, which I'm sure listeners would like to know more information about that. Can you tell us more about the role that Cheney played, and then also the role that the diversion of water played to support agriculture at the top of the river?
Essentially what happened was this was, so 2002, we're in the Bush Cheney administration, and they had lost the previous election in Oregon by a very small percentage. And so they were looking for ways to gain votes in Oregon. And Opportunity knocked when on the Klamath, at the top part of the Klamath Basin, one of the largest federal reclamation projects, and the farmers there needed more water in order to support, agricultural crops. And it was a drought year, and there wasn't enough water to support full agricultural deliveries and also support water flows for coho salmon on the Klamath, which the coho salmon are a listed species on the Endangered Species Act list. And so there was a lot of there's a National Academy of Science report. There was some other studies, and essentially they all showed that if you diverted, enough water to provide full agricultural deliveries, that there would be an ecological crisis in some form because water levels at the lower part of the river on the Yurok Reservation would fall the lowest they had ever been in history. There was, no record of flows ever being that low. But nonetheless, Dick Cheney, made the order, and the water went to the farmers. And as a result, at the bottom of the river, those flows were the lowest in history. And it killed all those salmon. It led to the closure of all of the West Coast salmon fishery for a few years after, and cost over $500 million in commercial fisheries losses. There was congressional reports, and there were lawsuits. There was a Washington Post article all about Dick Cheney's role in this. And essentially they all said it was an arbitrary and capricious decision where he overrided federal science and just made the choice. And obviously that was really hard. And I think at Yurok, we have a duty to try to encourage people to live sustainably and live in balance with the natural world. And so we've tried to learn from the fish kill. And I talk about in the book about how we are world renewal people, and we pray for the world, for literally the world to be renewed by restoring balance between humans and nature. And there was a ceremony that happened for the first time in 100 years right before the fish kill started. And in some ways, you could look at the fish kill as being sort of this very drastic way of triggering world renewal, because after those fish died, it really did tell the humans, whoa, if you guys keep operating the river in this way, it will collapse. The whole basin will collapse. And if the basin collapses, it won't be able to support any life, right? Humans, salmon, trees, anything. And so I think that was really the fish kill itself was like almost like the canary in the coal mine, alerting us that we really had to change the way that we manage the Klamath. And that launched the Undam the Klamath movement as we know it today, and really has, was sort of this catalyst to undamming the Klamath and the world's largest river restoration project.
Today, we are spending the hour with Amy Bowers Cordelis. She's a member and former general counsel of the Yurok Nation, the largest indigenous nation in the country. She's a fisherwoman, an attorney, co-founder and executive director of Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group, and author of the new book, The Water Remembers: My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. If you have any questions for Amy, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's step back and tell us more about the Klamath River. Tell us more about where you live. So the Klamath River is almost 6 hours north of San Francisco, and it's such a beautiful area. You write that this extraordinary area includes redwoods, the largest trees on the planet, rare fresh water lagoons, wild Pacific Ocean coastline, the fierce Klamath River. In the river, the third largest coho and Chinook salmon runs in the continental U.S., including a spring and fall Chinook run and fall coho run. You write about sturgeon, steelhead, trout, eels, candlefish, mussels, seaweed, abalone, whales, seals, birds, crabs, and so much more sea life. So can you tell people about this area?
Oh, it's remarkable. It's so beautiful. And it is still full of life. And, you know, so much of it is still undeveloped. So the Klamath River, where the mouth is, you know, right at my village of Rekwi, is right in the middle of the Redwood National Park. And, you know, so you have just this beautiful, wild coastline, you know, some of the oldest trees in the whole world. There are fresh water lagoons, which are super cool. And then you've got the river itself, which sort of winds through, you know, the first coastal range and the Cascades and Siskiyous, and then goes up, kind of follows the state line between Oregon and California, and then goes up into Oregon. But it's just such a vibrant, lively place with deep, rich colors. And especially at the mouth of the river where I'm from, there's almost water everywhere, right? Like you look out into the Pacific Ocean and you know, you can't see the end of it. And then the river, the estuary is deep and wide and this like beautiful green color. And then there's either mist or fog or rain in the air almost all of the time. And when, you know, the sun breaks the fog blanket, it's just this, like, it is sacred, beautiful, powerful experience. And I encourage everyone to come visit us. The Yurok tribe has, you know, like canoe rides you can take and interpretive trails. And it's really just a beautiful, beautiful, powerful place. And I'll say that in part, it's like that because my ancestors stewarded it that way, right? Like in our creation story, it talks about how everything was made first, the core of the earth, and then the ocean and the river, and then the plants and the animals, and then the humans last. And the creator told the Yurok people, if you live in a balance with this, you'll never want for anything. You'll always have what you need. And we lived that way for a really long time where we had very specific rules about when you harvested things and how much you took to make sure that everything came back more plentiful in the next year. And so, you know, that area, even to this day, looks a certain way because of that long land tenure there. And obviously that was disrupted about 170 years ago, but we continue to try to protect that land and exercise our duty to it as well as we can, you know, within the current sort of legal confines.
You're a member of the Yurok Nation, the largest indigenous nation in California. And you write about the Russian traders coming in the 1700s, and then 100 years later, European white settlers came. The federal government sent a treaty-making delegation to negotiate a peace treaty with your ancestors. Your third great-grandmother, Marka Shua Nellie Rubin, and a third great-auntie were toddlers, and your relatives, Sasamich and Wapasha, signed a treaty with the U.S. government in 1851, which would have secured your land, water, resources, fishing rights, and inherent sovereignty within your refined territory. And you write about how the state of California viciously opposed the treaty. I mean, we could talk for hours about the history of the Yurok Nation, but what else do people need to know about just what your ancestors went through? And I mean, it's really incredible that California nations and tribes are still here, because the history of California is very brutal.
It's extremely brutal. So by 1910, 90% of California's indigenous population had been slaughtered. You know, and even Governor Newsom in his term acknowledged that it was genocide. And I, you know, my ancestors were extremely lucky to have survived, and we were even more lucky to have stayed on our land. You know, my family's from the village of Recoy, right on the mouth of the river, and we've been there since time immemorial, and that's very unusual. And every generation, as you just mentioned, you know, faced a challenge, and, you know, not everybody made it, but some of them did. And, you know, by their strength, it is strength and prayer and determination, enough of us live to be able to continue to survive and fish and, you know, be on the river and on the land. But it's remarkable. And I felt really strongly about writing this story, because all those things you mentioned, I talk about those events as I was told the story. So this book, you know, there's an untold history in it. And I wanted the world to know what happened to at least, you know, one California indigenous family, but also, you know, our story is common to, frankly, like the indigenous experience across even the Pacific Northwest. And so it's a book that people can get an accurate, you know, real history of what happened to, an indigenous family. And it was cool because I felt strongly about writing the book in a narrative format. You know, of course it's nonfiction, but I wanted it to be an interesting read. I wanted to share the experience I had with readers of being on the Klamath River at fish camp, you know, sitting next to a fire with a gill net out in the river fishing, and listening to my ancestors, or not my ancestors, but, you know, my aunties and grandmas and uncles and dad and mom and my relatives, tell these amazing stories. You know, one of them is, you know, you mentioned the Russian sailors basically penetrating the redwood fog blanket and going into the mouth of the Klamath River, and, you know, meeting my probably fourth or fifth great grandparents and aunties and uncles. And the story I heard, and I tell this in the book, is that, you know, they came in and the Yurok people went down, the ancestors went down to check them out, and they got close enough to them that they could see that they were, and these are the Russian sailors, were covered in hair. And then they had these white bugs that were crawling in and out of the hair. And so, you know, my ancestors wouldn't let them off the boat. They said, "No way, you are not getting off the boat." And, you know, so eventually they left. But they're just these like nuggets of these sort of, you know, comical stories. But very true and very like real. And it's been just a joy to be able to, you know, write about them in a narrative format that I hope people really enjoy.
You know, before we go to break, I have to ask this question, because so many people are really struggling right now. Every day, there's so much heavy, heavy news coming at us. And you know, you're laughing about a lot of this, a lot of the past. And I wonder where you find this joy. I mean, you write in your book, "I learned our family history through oral histories told by my grandma and other relatives, but I hadn't lived through the very traumatic struggles of previous generations of my family. While I would later understand that I've always carried ancestral anger, I have, for the most part, lived with radical joy because I'm an Indigenous person. I was unapologetically proud to be Indigenous and wanted to learn as much about my culture as possible. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, well, my joy comes from the river and from my family. I mean, I feel extremely lucky to be from a very, you know, like, I'm pausing because there's so much gratitude and just love for my family and for our river and for our culture. Our river is a place of healing, and it always has been. Even, you know, when it itself was sick, you could go there and, you know, be on its bank, explore, play, fish, you know, sleep, whatever you needed. And it just has a way of speaking directly to your soul and healing you. And so I felt that. And also, you know, I feel like we are in this era where, for maybe the first time in history, Indigenous knowledge and lifeways are being respected more than they have before. Mm-hmm. And that feels empowering because, as we're seeing on the Klamath, Indigenous peoples have traditional knowledge that can heal the earth. And also, you know, as a lawyer, what I've learned is we have Indigenous peoples, you know, many tribes have extremely powerful legal rights in treaties and executive orders that are the supreme law of the land that have been dormant, that haven't been upheld. But when you use that knowledge and when you use those legal rights, and then when you, you know, team up with, you know, smart people and good-hearted people to leverage all of that, you can create unbelievable outcomes like we've seen on the Klamath. And so I just feel like, yes, we're in this awful moment, but also my family history shows us that we can get through it and that we will get through it, but we have to work towards sustainability and we have to look at our commonalities rather than our differences. And that's, you know, the path towards peace and the path towards sustainability. Hmm.
Beautiful message, Amy. Today, we're spending the hour with Amy Bowers Cordalis, a member and former general counsel of the Yurok Nation, the largest Indigenous nation in California. She's a fisherwoman and attorney who is instrumental in fighting on behalf of the Yurok and other tribes for removal of the dams on the Klamath River. As soon as those dams came back, the salmon returned. Amy Bowers Cordalis is co-founder and executive director of Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group. They help Indigenous peoples protect and restore the natural and cultural resources they rely on to maintain their identity and sovereignty. Her new book is called The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. If you're in the area, Amy has several events coming up. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera next Thursday, November 6th at 6 p.m., Copperfields Books in Santa Rosa next Friday, November 7th at 7 p.m., and Point Reyes Presbyterian Church on Saturday, November 8th at 4 p.m. That's sponsored by Point Reyes Books. You can find all of this information at kalw.org, click News, and Your Call. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. Today, we are spending the hour with Amy Bowers Cordalis. We're talking about her new book, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. Amy is a member and former general counsel of the Yurok Nation. She's a fisherwoman, an attorney, co-founder and executive director of Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group. If you have any questions for Amy, If you watched these dams come down, if you've been reading about it, what's your response to learn that when the dams come down, the salmon return? It's just really incredible to see videos of the salmon. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from a listener who would like you to talk about how young people have been responding to all of this. You say that once people saw this largest fish kill, it really launched a new generation of activism. So can you talk about that? And then what it's been like for you to see young people experience the salmon returning?
Yeah. Thank you to the listener for this great question. So as Indigenous peoples from the Klamath, I think most of us grow up hearing about the tremendous fight just to stay on our lands and our rivers and to practice our religion and our culture. And, you know, and then you're sort of also in this world of like, well, there's, you know, justice and freedom for all and these core American values that we're all supposed to have the opportunity to live the American dream. And it's sort of hard to reconcile those two different like histories and ideologies, but that's sort of who you are as an Indigenous person. And then, you know, you come into the fish kill and you see this attack on our river and our culture. And we all knew it was time to fight and to fight in a real hardcore way. And that launched, you know, many people. And it really began with these ultimate warriors who traveled the world with very little support and, you know, went to the dam owner company's shareholders meetings, whether those were in Scotland or Omaha or Portland or San Francisco, and they protested. And they fiercely protested. It was nonviolent, but they would show up to these meetings with huge banners that said, Warren Buffett kills salmon, you know, Warren Buffett kills Indians, these kinds of things. And they would participate in the public comment section of these meetings and make elaborate statements about how the dams were killing the river and killing the salmon and impacting negatively their ability to feed their families, you know, so because most people still to this day, you know, have a subsistence-based way of life and need those first foods in order to feed their families. But they were brilliant, you know, they were brilliant and they worked so hard with so little. And that really got the attention of the shareholders. It got the attention of the public that these dams were no good. You know, they were deadbeat dams. And, you know, also what was coming into light was that those dams were really legacy assets that were producing a very minimal amount of power and yet were, you know, killing a river and the lifeways of almost probably over 20,000 Indigenous peoples that live on the Klamath. And so it really then, you know, set the stage for the tribal governments and for others to come and participate in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission relicensing hearings and proceedings for the Klamath dams with sort of this baseline knowledge in the public that these dams were bad and really weren't producing much power. So, you know, we basically had to step up and continue the fight of our ancestors. And what for me personally was really interesting is because I, you know, watching the fish kill and observing the dead fish had this very powerful moment where I felt like my grandma, my great grandma, who had passed away 20 years before, really came to me and told me it was time to fight. And then the next thing I thought was I have to go to law school to try to, you know, work for my tribe and prevent this from ever happening again. And so, you know, I used the law to fight back. And what was really cool about the timing of all that, and I outline this in the book, is that the work of the previous two or three generations had reserved the Yurok tribe's Aboriginal rights on, you know, the lower Klamath River in our Aboriginal territory. And through that reservation, through the creation of the Yurok Reservation, we had vested those Aboriginal rights in federal law and, you know, then protected them through the 1900s against intrusions by the state of California through my great uncle's Supreme Court case. Which we should talk about that too, and another question. But long story short is that by the time, you know, I was in a position to uphold those legal rights, they were so strong, you know, and they really created this leverage that demanded dam removal. And so to continue that fight is one of the, you know, greatest honors of my life. And I think other people, you know, in the fight feel that way too. And now, you know, now, well, before I go on, I do want to say we fought because our lives depended on it. And they literally did. You know, we could not continue to be Yurok people if the salmon were gone. And by the time, you know, we're this is like the 2000s, even 2010, you know, we were down to single digit percentages of the historic Klamath salmon runs. You know, early we had talked about how the first 100 years of colonization wiped out 90% of California's indigenous peoples. Well, the second 100 years between like 1910 to 2010, over 90% of the Klamath salmon runs had been annihilated, and we were down to single digit percentages. And so, you know, my generation had to fight like our lives depended on it. And so now, you know, now we, the dams are out and the salmon are coming home. The river is more fierce and stronger and cleaner than I have ever seen it in my life. And what that does is enable the youth, you know, the next generation to experience this freedom. They can simply enjoy the river. They don't have to fight for it. They can just enjoy it. And we've seen that through, you know, the indigenous kayakers that did the first descent. I got to join them for the first day and then the last 3 days of the descent. And they play like otters. In our culture, otters remind us to be playful because they're always playing in the river. And that's what these indigenous youth were doing. They're in these kayaks, you know, doing cartwheels in the riffles and, you know, in their kayaks. That's a move that you do where you flip around and they're just playful, you know? And I just think like, it's our ancestors' dreams coming true to see them, you know, just to see them having a good time. They're on a healthy river. They're developing a deep relationship with the river through recreation. They're with each other too. And this is another point is like, it's not just the salmon going home. Like the salmon are reuniting all the people of the basin too. And the tribes are coming together in ways that we haven't been able to since colonization. And, you know, these indigenous youth who did that descent, like they're showing us the way because they're coming back together and creating community around the river, around first foods, around culture, around having fun. And that's a freedom that indigenous peoples on the Klamath haven't enjoyed since colonization. It's beautiful.
It's so beautiful. And Amy, I wish we had more time because we have so many more emails and a caller, but I want to make sure we talk about your Uncle Ray because we cannot end the show without talking about your Uncle Ray. You write, just a few years before you were born, your Uncle Ray's Supreme Court case challenging the state of California's authority to prohibit Yurok fishing was resolved, and the salmon wars over the federal government's authority to prohibit Yurok fishing ended. And Uncle Ray passed away almost exactly 1 year before the first dam on the Klamath was removed. As you write, he was labeled a renegade, a felon, a criminal. He had been prosecuted and targeted his entire life by federal and state governments just for exercising his Indian fishing rights. So we have some time. Tell us about your Uncle Ray.
Oh, he was the ultimate hero. He was the ultimate, he's like a legend, that guy. First off, he was strong. He wasn't tall. Yurok people are short. You know, he was probably 5'7", but he had long hair and he was the fisherman. And so he kind of had like a grizzly face, but he was extremely handsome. He was kind and funny, but the most fierce and intense person you've ever met. And he loved the river. He was raised, you know, by my great grandparents upriver at what we called a home place. It's about 12 miles upriver, and it was very secluded. It's on the Brooks Riffle, which is named after the family. And so he fished all the time, and he hardly ever left there growing up, in the 50s and 60s. And he knew the salmon, he knew the river better than anybody. And so he could smell where a salmon was. I kid you not. Like he knew it that well. And so he could catch fish like nobody's business. But he lived, and he also was extremely cultural. He knew so much about our culture because my great grandparents were basically raised in Aboriginal times by their grandparents. And so they spoke Yurok. My great grandma initially lived in a redwood plank house right at Rekwa. And so, you know, they passed this knowledge down to him. And so he just knew so much. But he lived in this time where the state of California had basically made his lifeway illegal. They had banned Yurok fishing in the lower Klamath River in a 1933 law. And so while he was fishing, he was also, you know, breaking state law. He was arrested 19 times for fishing on his home waters. 19 times by the time he was 26 or 27. And when I asked him about why, he said he knew that he had Indian rights, and those Indian rights were reserved, you know, by his ancestors in the creation of the reservation. And he was right. And the Supreme Court told him he was right, you know, but he literally gave up like his safety, his, you know, livelihood to prove that. The state of California, along with federal marshals, came and raided his house illegally. And he had kids, you know, and they would come in with, you know, machine guns and full riot gear in the middle of the night and just barge in and arrest him and take him to jail. And when they did that, they would take away all his fishing gear. They would impound his truck. And so he just had this extremely hard life because of it. But he knew that we had these fishing rights and that they were worth fighting for. And you know, and his Supreme Court case confirmed those rights. And so he was the ultimate hero. But then, you know, that really wasn't the end of it. And because then our salmon runs started dying, you know, there were the fish wars. And it is sort of tragic that he died a year before we took those dams out. But I will say that I remember, you know, looking and seeing the first dam, the first time I saw the dam that was removed completely, you know, looking at the river where the dam had been and it wasn't there anymore. I just felt so strongly that he was there with us and that he, you know, knew that the river was going to be healthy and that the salmon were going to come home and that he could, you know, rest a little deeper in peace, just knowing that. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And before we let you go, Amy, we have about a minute left. You write, "My family and nation should not have had to fight state and federal governments and power companies for two centuries to protect our rights, which are the supreme law of the land under the U.S. Constitution." Where did you all find the strength to keep up the fight?
our river and our culture and our duties to the creator. And that's where that joy comes from. We talked about that earlier. You know, we have deep, deep connections since the beginning of time, you know, that we've been on the river in our homelands. And that's worth fighting for. Our cultural practices, the way that we interact with the world, it's all about sustaining balance. And it's a beautiful way of living. And that gives us strength. Because there really is such a beautiful relationship between humans and earth when we show mutual respect. And I want to share with your listeners that that's not just limited to us. You know, a big piece of why I wanted to write The Water Remembers is because I wanted to share that value and let others know that they can make those same choices to live symbiotically with nature. And it just starts by having respect for nature and for each other. Right? But we can make that choice to respect nature and each other every day.
It's such a beautiful message that I think we all really need right now. Amy Bowers Cordalis is author of the new book, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. She's member of the Yurok Nation, the largest Indigenous nation in California. She's a fisherwoman and an attorney, co-founder and executive director of Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group. If you're in the area, she's got several events coming up. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera next Thursday, November 6th at 6 p.m., Copperfields in Santa Rosa next Friday, November 7th at 7 p.m., and the Point Reyes Presbyterian Church on Saturday, November 8th at 4 p.m. Find all the information, KALW.org, click news, and then your call. Thank you so much, Amy, for this beautiful book and for sharing your family's story. Thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you. Walk loud.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Damian Miner for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.